Our God has been so wild lately. He doesn't seem to listen. He doesn't obey my commands, and we can't even bribe him with treats.
He's gotten so out of hand, he may even have to be put down.
God is not the problem here. The problem is the people who want to be the leader of the pack. We reintroduce God. We retrain people. You're listening to The God Whisperers.
Are on the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by.
Hey, you're listening to the world famous, I'm tongue-tied, God Whispers. I'm Craig D'Onofrio.
I didn't know we were world famous.
We are.
We are. Okay, well, that's good.
We have fans in, we had one in Antarctica.
Infamous might be more.
Infamous, that's a good one, too.
Nice shirt, nice Hawaiian shirt.
Thank you.
Looking very aloha. We have dried mangoes on the workbench here, so we're feeling tropical today.
Yes.
And it's good. It's kind of gray, overcast, May gray out here in somewhat occasionally sunny Southern California.
I may go to Don the Beachcomber for a Mai Tai tonight.
That would be fitting.
I'm not sure.
You're already dressed for the part. How's trolling for missionary dollars going?
Trolling for missionary dollars. Well, we're busy. It's slowly trickling in. They say that you keep building your network, and you feel like you're getting further and further behind, and then all of a sudden it kind of snowballs, and then you're ready to deploy.
There's a snowball, then a blizzard, then an avalanche.
Yeah,
then they send out search parties.
Yeah, we're getting the ball rolling.
Okay.
We see every month our numbers are going up, but we still have a good ways to go. If you're interested in that, you can check out our blog, craigandpaula.org.
Craig and Paula.
It's kind of a...
It kind of sounds like a... kind of a wedding or an engagement site.
That was paulaandcraig.com was our wedding website.
Oh, that's why I'm getting confused. That's what my browser immediately defaults to it.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, I was just totally confused by
that. So anyway, craigandpaula.org, you can follow along, or lcms.org/D'Onofrio, D-O-N-O-F-R-I-O.
Beautiful. With us in studio, actually on the phone. We're in studio, which is an unusual thing to be looking at you.
I know.
But with us over the phone, a special guest, Heather Shote Davis, author and various other things. And the book in front of me, or the one that is of interest to me, is entitled Elijah and the SAT, Reflections on a Hairy Old Desert Prophet and the Benchmarking of Our Children's Lives. Welcome, Heather.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You have no idea what you're getting in for here, but I guess neither do we. So, but
we'll have fun. We'll have mango. It'll be good.
There you go. Yeah, this and Mai Tais probably as the afternoon wears on. Your book came to my attention via Facebook, and I think there was a somebody wrote an article. In, I think, the New York Times. Was it an op-ed piece in the New York Times about...
Well, it probably was, because there is an op-ed piece in the New York Times and the Atlantic and every thoughtful, you know, journalistic site there is at this point, pointing out the obvious, which is the system that we now have for moving our kids through the teen years and on into something like adult life is not working, and it is hurting many more kids than it's helping. And so... people are now bringing that to everyone's attention, and yet no one is really offering a solution. You know, what do we do with this wisdom? What do we do with this insight? Well, in a competitive culture that we live in, and the world that we all live in, I think you even have it in your intro about wanting to be the head of the pack. We are, by nature, people that want to be our own gods. That's a very hard paradigm to reverse. And as we know, there's only one way to reverse it, and that's the paradigm of God. And so that's what this book does, is it says, okay, let's take the Elijah narrative from beginning to end, and let's interweave that with some good commentary and factual information about the history of the testing culture and SATs and the AP course system and how that all changed in the last 50 years. And then as I was writing the book, and I think you've had a chance to read it, so now you're aware, there became a live, real-time memoir portion that was happening in my own life as my second child was in their junior year. I had just been through this with my son who was then in college. And so it was all very real for me. So there's the human, the mom part, as well as the theologian part and the part, all kind of woven and braided into one narrative.
Yeah, you first, your mom creds, you have, what, two kids?
I have two kids. My son is 26 and my daughter is 22 now. Yeah.
And so you've kind of you have gotten them through that apprenticeship period that
yes, I have.
They're now journeyman adults. So congratulations on that. Are they on their own, or are they still like most, like one third of millennials hanging with mom
in New York? I don't know if you saw this. It was actually fairly extraordinary, and so now I have to do a mom brag, although I didn't mean to do this. Is that he just actually won for the second time in 2 years a significant international competition called the Young Lions. It's for excellence in advertising and people under 27. And so he's now been in that career for 4 years, and he's going back to Cannes in 2 weeks because of this. And so it's a pretty major honor for him, and I'm excited for that, for him and that. And then my daughter has her own glorious ways to live out her vocation, and that's a great thing, and she is still at home, but barely.
Yeah, in your book, you kind of get to know them both a little bit. Maybe your daughter a bit more than your son. She's the artistic figure skater type, right?
Yeah, she is, and she's the one who was the junior as it was happening in real time, and also because a lot of people, if they know my work at all, will know that my very first book was my conversion memoir. And it is told as she is diagnosed with a brain tumor as an infant, and how during the time of whether I didn't know if she was going to live or die, Christ called me to himself. And so that book, which is called Baptism by Fire, which really all takes place at a little Lutheran church where I had just started because we put our son into the school there, certainly not for a religious education, but because it was small and safe and we thought it would be okay. And, you know, if he had to do a few coloring projects about David and Goliath, well, what could it hurt, right? We'd all done it and it hadn't had any lasting impact on us. And so
a little religion, it can't hurt anybody, right? Just a little religion, it's good for them.
Just a little religion.
Nice.
So that's where we were in that setting. God had prepared it so that we would be kind of in the bosom of a small church that could then embrace and care for us as we went through this very pivotal time, which ended up being the, you know, defining moment in my life. And so there are people who know Remy and kind of follow that. And so for some who have read Baptism by Fire, and that was actually published by a mainstream, that was published by Bantam. No Christian publisher would touch it because Christian publishers will tend to only like things that, you know, hit the same five notes and get in, get out, and don't have any of the mess of real life and language and all that good stuff. And but Bantam loved publishing it, and it did very well for them. So people who had read that book would recognize in Elijah a little bit of a refrain of that and were excited to kind of follow up.
So you actually became a Christian during a time of family crisis, which often is a crisis of faith for people who have faith. There are some people who go the opposite route when they're put in a position of having a sick child or something, and they kind of lose faith in the God who is good and gracious. Your experience is the opposite. You found a solid place to which to cling.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was a very profound season, and not for my husband. And it's interesting. I think sometimes the proximity to death to the mess of it is maybe part of it, but also maybe what had already been being prepared in my heart. I think I was already in a seeking process, seeking some larger overarching wisdom by which to navigate the world, and yet not really thinking that could possibly have anything to do with God or church or what I saw as Christianity in the world. So I think that was, I was already ripe for that. For that moment. And for him, and he was pretty much just home taking care of our son, keeping life on track, as I spent a lot of time in the hospital. You know, he did not have that moment. And he said just what you said, you know, this could not be a moment where I would believe, because what if it had gone the other way? What would that have meant? Yeah. You know? So, and I understand that too.
We'll have to probably have you back, talk about that first book. What brought you to, what drew you to Elijah when thinking about benchmarking kids?
Well, it's interesting because I was in a community Bible study. It's a big national organization. They put out really good materials. And it was the first time there were some people from our church who had gone, and we met in Santa Monica, and there were probably 75 different congregations represented. And the idea was just to really mix a lot of people together and just be in the Word. And it was the first time I'd really gone through very step-by-step, you know, curriculum like that. And we happened to be looking at the minor prophets and going through Elijah. And I just found that every single line of that narrative just opened up to me. You know, I would read three words and suddenly I could write, you know, five pages. And so I thought, oh, okay, this is something that was really instructive. And I was finding it was really helping me navigate my own life at the time. And this happened years before I read. I was thinking about writing the book for at least 5 years and waiting for the right season, waiting for the right way to do it. I really didn't have the angle. But I knew that there was something in Elijah that was connected to me, that was connected in my search for wisdom and how we navigate the world. And so, like, I mean, for one example is, you know, there was just that line about, and then the wadi dried up, and there was no more rain in the land, or something like that. I'm not going to say it correctly. And it was in that moment I thought, okay, that's how our lives go. It's all about provision. It's all about resources. And particularly if you're a freelance worker, which, you know, as an artist, as a writer, you're always working freelance. You're always trying to figure out, well, what do I do? And then you have to decide. You don't just do the projects. You have to decide which projects to do, and is that the right investment of your time? And so that whole idea of provision is different than someone who has, like, the steady paycheck. Well, we're now, you know, in a gig economy where more and more people are living that way. And so this issue of provision and choices and discernment becomes even more critical. And I just remember seeing that thing about the wadi drying up, and then at the end of that sentence, the next thing is, and then the Lord says, go. I've prepared a widow in advance to meet you, and she's going to take care of you. I thought, well, there it is. You don't get to know in advance what that next thing is. You don't get to know where that provision is coming from. He'll let you know when you need to know, and he's not going to tell you until whatever you've got right now is done, when it's dried up. And I thought, oh. There was so much in there that was helpful to me. And, you know, I returned to that again and again and again. It's not like, oh, I don't get anxious, and of course I do. But to be able to say, God is going to provide for you today until tonight. I think that there's the fridge is full. And when it's not full, then he's going to tell you what's next. And that's really what he's asking us to trust in and believe all the way along. And so I knew that that was instructive. And then there was this little comedic part. You know, I don't do a good, like, Borscht Belt accent or anything, but there was this voice, because I started thinking about Elijah. And at that time, I think I thought Elijah was young. I don't think I realized that he was older. And I thought, what is he doing down there at the Wadi Cherith for all those years? Like, what is he doing? And then I had this funny little voice thinking, well, as long as you're going to just be sitting down there all that time, why don't you bring your Latin root cards, you could review those a little bit, because I was in that season with my son where everything was about test prep and everything was about how do we make use of every little moment of time in those critical years of 10th, 11th, 12th grade where we're trying to launch them and make sure they look great on paper. And, you know, so I knew that there was some wisdom, and something about the story was not just about wisdom for me as an adult, but as a parent. And how do we figure this out for our kids, that we're leaning on the wrong thing? And then the more time I spent with Elijah, not so much books about him, because I read a bunch of them and I didn't really find that I was getting any more than I already knew. Mostly it was just in prayer. It was just going through all the First Kings narrative and into 2 Kings and every little passage for several years, and doing Lexia Divina with that, and then really having the fullness of the story. And then the moment came to start writing the story. I had gotten a bunch of work out of the way. There was suddenly going to be a year, like, okay, now's the time, now's the time. And I started writing it, and as you know, 5 weeks into starting the story, suddenly I realized, oh, my daughter's in her junior year, and stuff's starting to happen. And so it all, it affirmed to me that it was the right time to be writing it.
You know, you mentioned God's provision. And it's kind of curious that there's the promise of provision, but there's never an inkling that it's there. So it's like, give us this day our daily bread, not weekly bread, not monthly bread, not enough for the year, a decent retirement, just daily. And it's a day-to-day sort of trust. Elijah has the same thing. There's a famine. He's sent to a widow, and it's almost counterintuitive. He's going to sponge off her last flour and oil with the promise, don't worry. There wasn't like all of a sudden like 20 bags of flour and a bunch of barrels of oil showing up at the door. It's just I envisioned that there is always just enough, or like the feeding of the 5,000. It's not like all of a sudden two loaves of fish or five loaves and two fish become a whole pile. They just keep breaking it off and it just never ends, but you never get to see the abundance. You got to trust the abundance. It's just the promise is there. Just run with it. It'll be there. Give us this day our daily bread. That's kind of God's mode of operation. He ain't going to show you, but he'll promise you.
Yeah, we're getting a dose of that as we prepare to go on the mission field here, that we don't know when we're going to deploy, if we're going to deploy, or what's going on, where we're going to end up living and all the rest. But all I know is God usually gives me more than what I even ask for. And I think as we grow in Christian maturity, we learn to trust that God's got our back. You know, we just kind of go about the Christian life and assume that God will take care of us. Of course, that's not an excuse to be stupid and, rack up credit cards and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, faithfulness and irresponsibility are not, they're not synonymous. Okay?
No.
Just not. So now connected with the kids, what did you see going on? What troubled you? What caused you to change kind of the whole way in which you looked at mothering and what's going on with your kids and what we're doing with our children in society? Clearly something clicked there that really bothered you.
Well, I think what happened in particular when I got to high school with my son, I mean, I say, when I got there, like with my son, as if we're going together, that right there, that would be reflective of the problem that we think we're going with them. But you're trying to navigate. You're trying to help them understand. He had been in a little K-8 Lutheran school, and now suddenly he's going to be in a big public high school, which I was happy about. That was a good choice for him. He was a baseball player. He was put on the varsity at age 13, so that was going to be a big part of his life there. And he'd always been a good student, so I wasn't worried about that. And he'd go into the honors classes and what have you. But when we went to sign him up, the counselor said to us, he'll need to take some AP classes. And I said, no, he's in ninth grade. He's going to learn to figure out where the buildings are. He's going to get used to that. We're not taking any AP classes. And they said, if you don't take at least one AP class in ninth grade, and preferably more, he'll have no chance of going to even a UC school. Forget about any other, high-level Ivy League or any other school. And I said, even a UC school? You mean the schools like when I was growing up, that if you lived in California, had to be average, you went to school there? Like, you're telling me now that a 13-year-old has to take college-level work to even be eligible, to even think about that kind of path. And I said, that's just wrong. It's just wrong, and I won't do it. So fine, if that's not where, we're not going to do that. He's going to get settled in his high school life, and we're just going to trust. So in that sense, I think there was trust. But I'm looking around, and I'm watching what people are doing. I'm thinking, this is crazy. And he ended up in a class, and I think, was it 19? I don't even remember if I let him take one or it was in 10th grade. Now I'm getting my years mixed up. But he's with all of these kids who are just super gifted and super academically oriented. And he was very bright, but that just wasn't his life. His life was sports. And he was there. Everyone was gathered around doing some study group for some big AP class in European history. So I think it must have been 10th grade. And I got a call from him. And he said, Mom, come pick me up. And I'm joking. I'm like, oh, did they throw you out of the group because you guys are goofing off? He's like, no, come get me now. And I went over there, and all these girls who I knew, I actually had run an honors book club there at the high school. And so I knew they were lovely girls, very driven, and all the ones that are the high achievers that we read about. And one of them, the girl whose house it was breathing into a paper bag, and everyone else is huddled around her, and she's having a panic attack. And I'm thinking, this is not good. This is not right. These kids who already have been given every good gift do not have to be pushing themselves this hard. And so the more I thought about that and just prayed about that, it just was wrong in every possible way. And so I kind of just held the line with my son. We were focusing really more on him playing baseball. And it was like, you know what? If you want to go somewhere and play baseball, if that works out, great. Sometimes I got a little crazy about that. Other times I was okay about it. But it was really just trusting that there was a path and that it was going to be okay, and refusing to believe the idea that, you know, if your kid doesn't go to this preschool, they'll never get into the right elementary school, they'll never get into the right high school, they'll never go to the right college, and therefore they won't have the right social group, the right, you know, economic opportunities, and the whole thing is just ruined from day one. But where did that lie come from?
We
know where that lie comes from, right?
I'm one who went the other direction, dropped out of high school in 82, played music for about 5 years, then went to community college, then transferred into a four-year school, and ended up with a master's and part of a doctorate under my belt. But, you know, there are ways to do this that you don't have to kill yourself in the process with all of this. And I know, you know, unlike in the early 80s when I should have graduated high school, kids these days have to have more than a 4.0 to get into a Cal State. They have to have a 4.0 plus. And even Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, who is now a retired professor from Concordia Irvine, says, send your kids to a community college for 2 years, let them get the prerequisites out of the way, and then transfer. It saves a lot of money and a lot of headaches.
That's what my daughter's doing. It's a different world for sure. But it takes the parents believing that's okay. Because otherwise, now some kids are going to absorb. Some kids are naturally wired to be that level of achiever, and they're going to want to do that. And you know what? If they're driving themselves to do that, then okay. That's their own being. That's maybe who God has called them to be. But that may be 10% of kids. Mm. It's certainly not the amount of kids who are on that track now.
I remember it was a few years ago now, but my church is right next to a middle school, and so I often get the urchins parked on my front porch waiting for mom to pick them up or just hanging or whatever they're doing. So I came out there one time, there's a kid out there, I talked to him a little bit, and he's got this cell phone, and the kid's in sixth grade. I said, what do you got a cell phone for? And he says, my mom gave it to me so she knows where I am. And I said, really? I said, you know, when I was in sixth grade, I said, we used to go away on adventures on our bicycle, and we'd be gone the whole day, and our mothers had no idea where we were or what we were doing. And then we just come home at dinner, and nobody asked. And, you know, we washed up and had dinner. And he looked at me like I was telling him about visitors from Mars. He just did not understand the notion of a mother who would just let you go on your bicycle all day, and they had no idea where you were or trusted that you would show up for dinner at the end of the day. So
yeah, it was a different world, to be sure. And now, you know, we're always called as parents and as representatives of the gospel to help people navigate like where they are, the reality of their days. And these are the days that our kids are faced with and that parents are faced with. And so I would, you know, I would encourage parents to try to watch for their kids' level of stress and to try to emphasize learning over the transcript.
You know,
make the focus of conversation about what are you learning, what are you excited about, and trust that that's going to lead them where they need to go.
I can really speak firsthand to that, because one of the things I do on the side is I interview applicants to my alma mater, which is the University of Chicago. And you know, that's considered a top tier school, not only academically, but for what it costs too. And right. So I get to talk to like the best and the brightest, supposedly, of you know, this year's graduating class, and they are really, they're amazing and very impressive and scary. And some of them look frightened and sad and stressed. When you look at the resume of AP courses they've taken, all the extracurriculars they have to do, you know, you want to ask, I always ask the question, what do you do for fun? And some of them can't answer the question. Or, you know, what do you do for creativity? And they just look at you blank. I don't think it occurred to them that there was a free hour in the day to paint or draw or write or compose a song or just sit and do nothing.
No, there isn't. And, you know, we took that away from them when we started saying to high school kids, you need to use your summers to do impressive things to build your college application. And your two choices are, one, do some kind of exotic travel that involves you helping poor people or, you know, somebody who's wounded or broken so that you can show that you're caring and that you've done those things, right? Or the other is to get an impressive, some kind of internship, to start working in some kind of real life experience in your area of expertise. And everything's about getting that leg up, getting that little edge. And so that summertime, which used to be that glorious season of rest and downtime, and, you know, maybe you had a little summer job making smoothies, but that was fun because it gave you pocket money so the rest of the time you could go and, you know, stargaze or do some silly thing. I remember my son's one silly thing he did in his senior year with some boys, like for a week, they all went to one of the guys' houses and they just dug a big hole in the backyard. And they were just so excited about that, digging this big hole. It's like their final act. And I was so grateful for the mom who was an English teacher who just let them dig this big hole that had absolutely no purpose, but that they were very excited about this project. And all of those boys have gone on and done great things. And certainly the discipline of sports. And that would be the other thing I would say. Let their hearts lead so that they can follow. They can know the feeling of applying themselves towards something that they're passionate about and see what happens in the growth in that. I mean, that's just really, really key. And then focus on these areas of character, because what I see in my kids now, and the one thing I really believe to be true, is if they know how to apply themselves, if they have self-discipline, if they know how to sit with the projects and go, okay, let's break it down, let's move it forward, let's do this, they can take that skill, and whether they developed it in sports or in theater or in the robotics club or whatever it was, they can apply that to anything in life and be successful way beyond someone who all they know how to do is jump through hoops. Like the world is saying, here are the hoops. Get through them, get through them, get through them. And then you know what happens? Those kids who do everything that was asked of them, and they have 4.4s, and they have all these exciting things that they've done, and they've been the head of this club and the head of that club, they go and they apply to these top-tier schools who accept 5% of the applicants because all of the applicants are that good. You've told them at the time when they should be launching their life that who they are is somehow just not quite good enough. And what does that mean if you've just done everything to the best of your ability? That's not a good foundation. And now you've got kids, and I know this, I was giving a presentation on Man Turned In on Himself, and I talk about some of this anxiety that happens and how parents, you know, it's like the sins of the father. It's our anxiety about them somehow being left behind in the global economy or whatever that forces us to push them this hard, right? So I saw this dad who's a pastor, a beautiful man, just weeping. And he's like, I didn't realize I had done this, but now I realize that I did. I thought my daughter was just bright and I was so excited to see her do well, but now she's off in college and been sent home with an identity crisis and unable to function.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Taken it's, like 3 or 4 years of therapy, you know, to be able to get her fixed.
They come home with an identity crisis and an eating disorder, and you wonder how that happened, you know. And it's all the bundle of expectations and anxieties that are thrown on them. It's not their own; it's laid on them by parents. Do you think parents today are living through their kids?
Oh, I think there's a lot of that. You know, and again, when we say parents, we got to say there's a lot of different kinds of parents. We've got different socioeconomic groups, and so it'll be different in different groups and different cultures. But certainly there is a lot of that. And we would do well to just disengage a little bit. That would be a healthy thing and let them find their own way. And then the other thing that I really feel strongly about in terms of a gift to them, and maybe this is part of the disengaging, is teaching your kids to be comfortable with silence, which is something that no one does anymore. And like young parents will ask me, they'll say, what's your one piece of advice, Heather? And I will say that to them. I'll say, when you get up in the morning, do not turn the TV on. Do not grab your laptop. Do not do any of those things, and let them know what it feels like to sit alone in their room and or in the afternoon or whatever it is without any media, so that they can be comfortable with stillness. That's something, that's the gift of Elijah, right? Sitting down there and praying, because you're going to have to learn to be able to pray. You're going to have to be able to hear God. You can't hear God if there's five channels going on.
Heather,
I'm
sorry.
Whether the God piece is real to them or not, if they know silence, he can reach them.
We're going to go a little long, and I'd like you to address this also. In norming the kids with testing, SATs, and all the rest, you know, we talk about the UCs and the Bill School in Chicago and all of this, but I have friends who are professors in the Concordia system, and they've lamented that many of the kids who come to the school, they have to teach remedial classes to these kids because they've only studied for the tests and never really learned the English language or really learned some very basic things that we learned as kids before the no child left behind sort of thing. Did you look into that at all?
Well, I think that we see it. I mean, I remember probably 15 years ago, even that would be something that was striking me as a disconnect, because I had a teacher friend. She was a pastor's wife who taught ESL at UCLA. And I'm sitting here thinking, she told me about all these kids who had to take it. And I'm saying, okay, help me reconcile these pieces of information. You need a 4.4 to go to UCLA, but you're telling me that 60% of the incoming students have to take remedial English.
Yeah.
How do those two go together? Well, a lot of it has to do because there's a heavy up on the math science emphasis. So you've got a lot of gifted people, particularly international students, who can score high in the math and science, and then they say, okay, well, we'll just carry them through the English, and maybe some of that is English as a second language issues. And so there's some of that going on. I think also because, like saying, that the teaching to the test means that kids have not learned the strategic and critical thinking that is so important, and maybe that's because none of them are really reading the books that they're supposed to be reflecting on. They're just grabbing the pieces of the cliff notes, or they're working in study groups and everyone grabs a piece, so they're never actually even looking at the whole. Mm. It's not about learning. It's not about understanding for them. It's about, what do I have to do to get the A and get out? So once you've taken the actual love of learning out of it, and let's face it, a lot of kids when they're in high school are not loving learning. They're thinking about something else. Well, and those things are important too. I wish we could get to a place where we would say to kids, honestly, hey, listen, between like 13 and 25, here are like 20 things you're going to want to learn and make progress on. And they're not going to happen in a linear fashion, and they're not going to happen in a predictable timetable. And when you get to the end of them, if all of these things have somehow to get, you know, come together, you're going to be fine. But that's not what we do.
I think that's why I like to label that period between 13 and say about 25 or so as apprenticing. You know, if you're learning a trade, you don't learn it all at once and you don't progress linearly. You progress in these little fits and starts and successes and failures. But the key is you hang around with people who have put in their 10,000 hours, you know, who kind of know what they're doing and who guide you. And I think that's the thing that's missing when it's all performance based, is you're not baking bread at home with the folks. You're not, you know, I learned to build by building things with my dad and listening to him to, you know, cuss out things when he cut the lumber too short. And but, you know, it's that there's some, that's what was going on during the summer, the out of class time. You know, we weren't preparing for tests. We were building things with dad or baking bread or doing stuff. And these are invaluable life skills that are all part of that. Probably it's on your list, you know, and you don't learn all that in a classroom filling in little bubbles with your number two pencils.
Right. No, you don't. And so as people who know and love God and want to be able to have an impact on the world in some way that is healing and restorative, I think that is one thing that we can be mindful in whatever communities that we're drawn into, whether it's through a church or school or our own families or whatever it is. How do we get some of the pressure off these kids? How do we reteach and reintroduce the beautiful doctrine of vocation, whether it's done in theological terms or just in lived out terms? Look at you. Look at you, what you're meant to be. Look at this beautiful thing you've been gifted to do. And suddenly now, look, here you are in this situation where you can use that gift. And that grows. Notice that that can happen throughout your life when you are in contact with the God who created you, you know?
So, one more time, where can people get the book and what's it called again?
The book is called Elijah and the SAT. You can get it on Amazon. You can get all my books on Amazon. My writing name is Heather Choate Davis. And if you just go onto Amazon, or you can go to my website, which is Heather, H-E-A-T-H-E-R, Choate, C-H-O-A-T-E, Davis, D-A-V-I-S.com. And you can find all my books there. I've written on a variety of things since I got my master's in theology. I've been focusing more in that area. I just had a little book that I call Backpack Apologetics called Happier Those, that was like life wisdom that you can hand to a college graduate or someone else and work through some of those challenging arguments that they have. That's something that I think that you will find young people resonating with. And
it's a devotion on Psalm 1. It's a devotion on Psalm 1. Heather, it's been a pleasure having you with us.
Thanks for being with us, Heather.
And the Lord's blessings to you and your kids. Glad to hear that they've made it.
Thank you. Thanks so much. God bless you.